So we come to the fourth week in a four-week series exploring imagination through the Buddhist tradition and in our own practice. I think I'm aware there's quite a few people who... Are there quite a few people here who haven't been here for any of it? Can you just say if you haven't? Yeah. Yeah. So I'm only going to be able to do a very brief recap because we haven't got loads of time this evening. But there are audio recordings of last week and the week before, and I've also put very full notes together, which are available on the website, which recap each week, and they've got all the quotes and the images that I've used and things like that. So if there's anything you want to catch up with, or if there's something this evening that doesn't make sense, you'll probably find it there, or feel free to come and ask me in the tea break. So we started out in the first week looking at Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the original Buddha, and his teachings, and introducing imagination in that way, and looking at, well, why does imagination matter? And saying that for the Buddha it was something, in a way he took for granted so much there wasn't even a special word for it. Devans suggested that we can translate the word sati, which is sometimes translated as mindfulness, as imagination. And I think it was a faculty, a way of relating that was very current in the time of the Buddha. I think in our day and age we tend to rather poo-poo imagination, or it tends to get a bit dismissed or not taken very seriously on the one hand. But on the other hand, I think it also gets captured and taken hostage. That was what I was suggesting in the first week, whether by consumerism, by anxiety, by political ideologies, by whatever means. I think we were looking at how if we don't actively, creatively use our imagination, it will use us in a kind of reactive way and will keep us on the wheel. And that it's very relevant, very important, because we have these powerful energies inside of us, which we talked about as the kings and queens of our energies that lie dormant and actually only wake up when there's something that captures the imagination, brings them to life, really brings our energies out to engage with what we most want to do. And we also talked about the need to be warriors of the imagination in that sense of... we're not on a level playing field. There's the world all around us is encouraging us to be passive recipients and not to actively use our energy and our imagination. And the thing that we need to do to contact it, one of the things, is just very simply stopping and sitting with the Buddha, letting ourselves go quiet, connect inwardly, and actually start to listen to what's actually speaking to us from our own imagination inside of us. And that's a very radical, a political act even, to just sit still, stop consuming, stop angsting, just be. And it's contagious, I think. Just like anxiety is contagious, I think really dropping into a stillness is something that can be contagious. We went on to look at the next unfolding of the Buddhist tradition with the great phase called the Mahayana, when stories, myths and parables became much more part of the currency. And we looked at it as a shift from perhaps a model in the earlier time when there was very much a focus on the path and striving towards nirvana, to a phase that was much more characterised by the image of the lotus and kind of unfolding one's qualities and potentials. And we looked at how actually in our spiritual lives we need both the path and the lotus, that there's a positive side to both and they also have a downside, and you need to kind of learn to dance between them. So we have this lovely model of the polarity map where we go too far one direction. It's like, oh no, we need a bit more energy and vigour. Oh, it's all got too much energy. We need to kind of relax and open, or it all goes a bit floppy. So learning the dance of the spiritual life, that was part of what we looked at in the second week. And how we all have these seeds of potential in us. It's not like enlightenment is something out there that we need to acquire. It's actually there within us, but it's like a seed. We all have different seeds of inspiration and potential in us that are inert and actually need the rain of the Dharma. They need moisture, warmth and light to bring them to life. And we've all got different seeds. We'll all become different kinds of plants in the same garden or forest, but actually unfolding who we really are most fully. And we had that lovely quote from the Dhammapada: your work is to discover your work, and then, with all your heart, to give yourself to it. So that led us to the third week, last week, when we were looking at Tantric Buddhism and the mandala. And we also looked in some detail at the image of the Vajra, Tantric Buddhism is also called the Vajra Yana, the way of the Vajra. And this is a symbol, very powerful symbol, both of the path of transforming the poisons, you could say transforming our reactive mind into wisdom's or the creative mind. And that's all energy. We can see the spiritual life, that it's actually all energy. Whatever happens, it's energy that we can transform. We can bring our awareness into relationship with it. It will transform. And that's the way that we free ourselves from our reactive habits and patterning. That's the way that we can become free. We also looked at how, when we start to practice in that way, a lot of energy can get stirred up. These kings and queens of our imagination, when they start waking up, they're actually quite feisty. And they not only perhaps cause conflict internally, but they can get us into conflict externally. We're practicing in different ways. Even in the Sangha, we can bang up against each other. And so we need to understand how those energies can pattern themselves in a harmonious way. So that was why we came to look at the image of the mandala. A mandala is a harmonious arrangement of anything, really. But we could say in this case, our kind of psycho-spiritual energies, around a centre, which is what really holds meaning and value for us. And for each of us, the sense of what's in the middle will be different, but resonant. We all have particular focuses, particular things that capture our own imagination. And we concluded by talking about what is known as the mandala of the five Buddhas. So this is a representation of the enlightened energies of Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, as if imagined that he was like a white light, and it's refracted into the colours of the rainbow that bring out these qualities of the enlightened mind. And we're going to pick up there this week and just remind ourselves. So, as with last week, I shall just remind you, we've got in the centre of the mandala, we've got the white Buddha Vairochana, the illuminator. The Buddha family, he's associated with light, with space. In the Eastern realm, we have the blue Buddha, Akshobhya, the imperturbable, the unimovable. He's very much associated with wisdom and the Vajra, the energy of anger, but that energy that wants to cut through to wisdom. We go clockwise around the mandala to the Southern realm, and you meet the yellow Buddha, Ratnasambhava, the jewel-born. So he's very much associated with abundance, generosity, creativity. Ratna means jewels. That leads around to the Western realm, where we have the red Buddha, Amitabha, associated with the warmth of the setting sun, very much associated with love, with metta, with meditation, with friendship. We've got the Western realm, also associated with faith. We've got faith and wisdom. And then in the Northern realm, we meet the dark green Buddha, Amoghasiddhi, unobstructed success. So he's very much associated with energy, transforming energy into fearlessness, all accomplishing wisdom. So this is a very simple representation that can actually is very, very profound, and it can actually show us in all sorts of ways how we can come across purposes with each other. If one person's really at the bottom of something with a kind of wisdom badgered approach, and their friend is going, no, it's like this, we need to just be receptive, and we need to open, and we need more empathy. We've set the ground for a lot of miscommunication. If you've got a big enough perspective that encompasses these different energies, you can start to work creatively with them rather than reactively. So where we're going with this week is that I want to introduce another figure, a very important figure from the Tantric Buddhist tradition, from the Vajrayana. And this figure is so important in the establishment of Buddhism in Tibet. He's often known as the second Buddha. And that's Padmasambhava. His name is Padmasambhava, it means the lotus born. So very briefly, the story is, around about the 8th century, the abbot Shantarakshita wanted to establish the Dharma in Tibet. And he wanted to build a great big monastery. And they started practicing, they started building the monastery. And they'd work very hard all day building the monastery, preparing. And each morning they'd go back and they'd discover that overnight the demons had been in and they'd knocked the monastery back to the ground and they had to start again. So it doesn't take much to see, you can understand this metaphorically. I've certainly had this experience, I don't know about you. I kind of practice all day and I go to bed in a positive mental state, something happens in the night and I kind of wake up and it's like, oh God. Right, okay. Something's at work within my psyche that's not in my conscious control. So one way of understanding that is that that's the kind of energy that is known as demons. They take all sorts of forms. They can be negative, destructive energies that destroy things or break things down. They can also, they also manifest as God demons. Now, these are very interesting because they're those sort of opportunities that are too good to miss, and they're much more about kind of craving. And they're things that lure us in. But either way, it's all energy. It's all habits of mind that manifest, which actually get in the way of us making aware, conscious, creative choices. And we need to learn to work with them. And this is where Padmasambhava comes in. So what happened in Tibet was they thought, oh, we need to send for Padmasambhava. He's renowned for working with transforming, taming the demons, transforming the energy so that it can actually be energy in pursuit of the good. So Padmasambhava has actually been here the whole time these last 4 weeks. You may not have noticed him, but he's sitting there on the back windowsill. And he's also been here in my heart, because there's also quite a few demons in there quite often, so I tend to keep him pretty close. He's never far away, in fact. It's one of the things that he says, I'm never far away from those who have faith and those who don't. You just call on Padmasambhava. And I think he's a very powerful embodiment of this capacity to transform the demonic energy that wants to stop us in our practice. But he's also, in a certain way, an embodiment of all the energies of the mandala. So I thought what we'd do is we'd invite him to come and be more visibly present. And we'd do that by chanting his mantra. And a couple of years ago, I learned an interesting thing about the Padmasambhava mantra, which is that there's a way of understanding it which actually relates it to the five Buddha mandala. So, how this goes is that you have the centre of the mandala, and you have Om, Ah, and Hum. That's, in some ways, it's body, speech, and mind. But then you have the Vajra, Guru, Padma, Lotus, Siddhi, Amoga Siddhi, Hum. So that's a certain thing that happens when we chant the mantra. We can imagine it as gathering up all these energies. So I'm going to start the mantra, and then Padmasambhava will make his way onto the shrine. And do join in, of course. Om Ahum Vajraguru Padma Siddhi Hum. 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 Om Ahum Vajraguru Padma Siddhi Hum.
Om Aum Vajraguru Padma Sriham. 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 Om Aum Vajraguru Padma Sriham.
So I think the reason Padmasambhava wandered in when I was preparing this talk is because he's a very important link for us between the Vajrayana, the tantric tradition, and our own tradition with Bante, with Sangharachita. We call Sangharachita Bante, it just means teacher. It's a kind of affectionate way of referring to him, if any of you don't know that he has these different names. And Bante's found that Padmasambhava's really stirred the energies deep in his heart, just as we were saying with looking a couple of weeks ago at what are the seeds in our heart that get kind of stirred and awakened. Well, for Bante, I think Padmasambhava's been a very powerful stirrer of big energies in him. And he describes the first time he saw an image of Padmasambhava in Darjeeling early in the 1950s. And he'd never seen a Nyingma temple before. He'd never seen a temple of Padmasambhava's lineage before. And he says, as I entered the temple, all the greater was the shock, therefore, when I saw in front of me, three or four times larger than life, the mighty sedent figure of the legendary, semi-legendary founder and inspirer of the Nyingma tradition. A skull cup in his left hand, a staff topped with skulls in the crook of his left arm, and the celebrated wrathful smile on his moustached face. All this I took in instantly, together with the lotus hat, the richly embroidered robes. Having taken it in, I felt that it had always been there, and that, in seeing the figure of Padmasambhava, I had become conscious of a spiritual presence that had, in fact, been with me all the time. In other words, that magical figure had activated, at a very deep level, a part of me that hitherto had lain dormant and unrecognized. And that connection has stayed very, very strong for Bante over the years. In 1962, so about 12 years later, he was given an initiation into the Padmasambhava visualization practice. And at that time, his teacher, Kachi Rinpoche, bestowed upon him another name, which is Urgyen. And he is often known as Urgyen Sangharachita, where he lives at Adishtana. His part of the building is known as the Urgyen Annex. And Urgyen is a Tibetan form of the word Uddiyana, which describes a region northwest of India, which is where Padmasambhava is said to have originated. And a fascinating thing about Padmasambhava is he's half historical, half mythical. There's lots of legend about him, but there is a sense that at some point there was some kind of being who existed in the 8th century who was Padmasambhava in a physical, material way. So all this is very mythic and imaginal, and for some of us that's very irritating. I just wanted to say that, because I mean, we all have these different responses. Not everything works for everybody. And certainly when I first got involved, I liked the fact the Dharma was very clear and straightforward, and I just couldn't see why they needed all these men in funny hats. But gradually, and particularly on that retreat at Rivendell I talked to you about a couple of weeks ago, something connected in my heart mind, or more perhaps some of the kings and queens of my energies started to wake up and go, actually there's something in this. They were being spoken to by these images, even if my rational mind wasn't. And like we've been saying, the imaginal, the mythic, has a vital role to play in enabling us to gather and motivate our energies, in waking up those dormant seeds. And it's a key to understanding Bhante Urgyen Sangharakshita and his presentation of the Dharma. Bhante is a living, breathing, historical figure for us at the moment. He's still alive, he's 91, he lives in Herefordshire. But he's also a kind of portal or a guide through which we can connect with the vastness of the realms of imagination, of the realms of higher consciousness, of the realms of enlightenment. And it's really only our imaginative faculties that really have the power to connect with that. Like I was saying in the first week, they're the part of us that has the capacity to go beyond ego clinging, to really dwell in that realm which is more than our mundane day-to-day experience. So let's stop and look at the shrine. So we've got an image here. The shrine represents, in whatever way, an image of where we're heading. And it's up to each of us to imagine what that looks like individually. But we have these collective images. So here, from the urban retreat last week, we've got this big painting of Vairochana, who's the white illuminator Buddha in the middle, illuminating Buddha in the middle of the mandala. He's the still point, the centre of the mandala of the five Buddhas. But don't forget that behind him, here, we've still got Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha. And I was thinking about that when I was writing my talk and thinking, it's lovely actually, we've got this metaphor here with the shrine, because actually for us in Sri Lanka, the historical Buddha is always there behind everything. Like we were saying in the first week, he's our touchstone. He's always there, and like with Pingya, he's always there in our imagination if we connect with him. So now we've got Padmasambhava sat in front of Vairochana. So it's interesting, how do we feel about approaching Padmasambhava? Quite a different kind of energy to Vairochana. And he's called the Vajra Guru, or the Tantric Guru. And actually, as we approach our ideal, any of us who've ever really, you think, right, I'm going to do this, I'm going to walk towards what I most want to do, what always happens is the demons come up to meet you. It's almost guaranteed, it's almost inevitable. So in a sense, now we've got Padmasambhava there to help us deal with the demons that come up between us and the ideal. You can see that as what that's embodying. But then what do we make of Padmasambhava? How do we relate to Padmasambhava? In some ways, he's quite an alien figure, and he looks a bit, well, he's got that so-called semi-wrathful smile. Actually, we need an intermediary between us and Padmasambhava. So I think that's where we can bring Bhante in. And this picture of Bhante has just arrived today. It comes from Padmaloka, a retreat centre in Norfolk, which is named after Padmasambhava. And it's a painting that was done by Arloka, who also did our painting of the Buddha. And it's a very particular image of Bhante, a very mythic kind of image, and it's him as a guide to the beyond, you could say. It's got a long, complicated name I won't bother you with, but the basic image is that Bhante's there in his cardigan, you might notice, he's wearing his green cardigan, and he's got his hand out, and he's inviting us to something more, something beyond. And this sort of nimbus, it's very light, if you remember what's behind the head of the Buddha there. It's this sense of, it's a evocation of an inconceivable realm. So I think what we could do is we could have Bhante here in front of Padmasambhava. And you start to get the sense that, in a way, he's the portal he's a translator, if you like, of the myth, the symbol, the language of the archaic aspects of the Buddhist tradition. With his help, we can make the transition through. With Padmasambhava's help, we can transform the demons, and we can approach whatever our blissful idea of a completely peaceful Buddha may be, or whatever it is for you. There's a path, and in a way they represent guides on the path. So I wanted to remind us about something I was talking about in the second week, when we were talking about teachings of explicit meaning and teachings of implicit meaning. So there's some teachings, like the early teachings of the Buddha, like the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path. They're really quite clear and straightforward. They're quite unambiguous. You get more into the realm of imagination with the Mahayana, with the Vajrayana, and it becomes much more implicit, or you could say we're in a realm of undefined meaning. It's very easy to get hold of the wrong end of the stick. It's very easy, if you like, for our reactive minds to get hold of something. I mean, just think about the way that people just associate the Tantra with sex. It's like, now I think there's a bit more to it than that, and I think there's a bit of an oversimplified understanding going on here. Definitely, there's a saying in the Buddhist tradition that you can get hold of the wrong end of the snake. The Dharma's like snake, and you can get hold of the wrong end, and you can imagine how disastrous that is. So we need a guide. And actually, I was thinking, even talking about Padmasambhava as the Vajra Guru, I mean, guru's got a pretty dodgy feel for a lot of people in this day and age, as a word, hasn't it? It's not really got good currency. And I think Bhante was aware of that right back in the 70s. He did this really good lecture. I recommend it. It's called Is a Guru Necessary? And he actually unpacks what do people think a guru is, what do they want, why do they want it, what actually is a guru. I mean, to cut a long story short, his conclusion overall on that is that actually what we need is friends. This is where our emphasis, it's one of the ways in which our emphasis on friendship in Sri Ratna comes about. Bhante talks about how we need friends kind of on a horizontal level, if you like, our peers alongside us to encourage us, support us and challenge us. And we also need what he describes as friends who are on a kind of more horizontal, more vertical relationship. Someone, if you like, who's a bit kind of further up the mountain, so they've got a bit more of a view of the terrain, and they can help you sort of see the wood for the trees. And this is very much how I think we can see Bhante here. He's there as a friend, inviting us to explore and discover these wonders that are there, that can be reached through spiritual practice in whatever way, whether you're doing it in a path way or doing it in a lotus way. So we really need our spiritual friends, and I think Bhante said on more than one occasion we could see his relationship to the order as that of friend, and particularly in that kind of vertical kind of way. And it's worth remembering that, as I say, both kinds of friends, horizontal friends, vertical friends, they can support us on the way, they can encourage us, but they can also challenge us. And it's one of those things where we do need both. If we find things that are challenging either from our mates or from Bhante, it's like, actually, we need challenge, otherwise we'll get into that settle down, that part of the dance where we just chill out so much the lotuses go smelly. Remember? It's like, you need the challenge to kind of wake up the energy. And it's not always the most welcome part of the spiritual life, but actually it's indispensable. And it can be very annoying as well, because we can want Bhante to be all sorts of things other than a friend, and a friend who's going to tell us things sometimes that we don't want to hear. Lots of us can want him to be the perfect teacher. It's like such a relief. It's like, oh, I found a teacher. Great. I don't have to worry now. He's going to tell me the way it is. Phew. Sometimes we want a father substitute. We just want somebody on a pedestal who's going to give us all the answers that we can just trust unthinkingly. That's not Bhante's presentation of the Dharma. He wants us to trust ourselves. He wants us to be open to the counsel of the wise, as it's often called, to our vertical friends, to the wisdom of our peers, our horizontal friends. But we have to rely on our own experience. We have to come from those seeds, that experience inside us, and stay true to that. And I think in understanding Bhante, it's really worth being aware of how it's such a central tenet of his, that it's almost like one of those things that's described as an unconscious competence. It's second nature. I think in a way it never occurs to him that somebody would do something that they didn't want to do, and especially not that they do it when they didn't want to do it, because they think he thinks they should, if you see what I mean. You know, I should do this, Bhante says I should do this, but really I don't want to. And we can get ourselves in all sorts of knots like that. And actually what he says is, look at your experience, go deeper, find what you most want to do and do that. Even if it's the polar opposite of what you think you should do. You have to follow your heart, you have to integrate your energies, take them with you. You can't just leave out the bits that you think aren't tidy, don't fit. Bhante says it's like this, so I'm going to do it like this. I'll just leave all that over here. Doesn't work. I know, I've tried it for several years. So I wanted to say a bit more about Bhante himself. Obviously none of us would be sitting here this evening if it wasn't for him. There wouldn't be an order. There wouldn't be order members, there wouldn't be mitras, there wouldn't be friends, there'd be no centres, no classes, no retreat centres. There wouldn't be the global Buddhist movement called Tri Ratna if it wasn't for him. And these emphases that we have here, you don't find all through the Buddhist world. They're emphases that he's given us. This emphasis on imagination, on sangha, on friendship. It's a very particular thing that he's brought out in his presentation of the Dharma. So you might know that he was born in Tooting in London in 1925. And the most significant event of his early life was that when he was 8, he was told he had to stay in bed. And he had to stay in bed for 2 years because they thought he had a heart problem. And as he says in his inimitable style, I promptly developed a habit of avid and incessant reading, which never afterwards left me. And I think this is a very, very significant thing about Bhante. He really does read a lot, as his 11,000 books in the library at Adishtana will testify. And he describes how he devoured the Harmsworth Children's Encyclopedia, of which not a page of those 61 parts remained unread. But he says, actually, within that, he became aware that he had certain tendencies, things he was more interested in that awakened his imagination, history, art, literature. Strangely enough, the philosophy section, which discussed abstract ideas such as truth, beauty, goodness, and justice, all of which the editor had stoutly capitalised, failed to awaken in me the love of wisdom. So it's just interesting. Again, he's talking about what captures his imagination. And at that point, it wasn't philosophy, it was poetry, art. And very early, well, when he was about 12, he started reading Milton. There's a lovely story about when he first came across Milton. And Milton's one of his great poetic loves, and he just describes that Christmas, 1937, I met with a book. That's interesting. He's kind of experiencing it as a meeting. He's not just saying I read a book. It's like I met with a book that swung me almost violently from art to literature. It was the greatest poetic experience of my life. And then there's a lovely bit of Bhante's hyperbole. That apocalypse of Miltonic sublimity that made of me, from that day onwards, if not a poet, at least a modest practitioner of the art of verse. And Bhante as poet is a very, very important aspect of him. He's written loads of poetry. There's a fat blue book of it. It's variable. I think he admits it's variable. The way that Bhante's a poet is more than in the writing of verse. He's a poet in how he sees the world. He's a poet in how he communicates the Dharma. I think the thing we really need to understand is that he's a poet in how he's created the movement and the order. In a way, it's his greatest poem. I'll leave that one hanging. The other thing I want us to really be aware of was each time with Padmasambhava, with Milton, each time it was as if something in him was woken up. And he responded wholeheartedly. He really noticed, he really followed that. Those things have carried on resonating with him through his whole life. He's remembered, there's that recollection. He reflects a lot on his experience. Somebody said to him once, how could I be more like you? And he said, reflect on your experience. Reflect on conditionality in your experience. It's a path to insight, that reflection. There's more I'd like to say about Bhante's other literary heroes, but there isn't lots of time. But it's fascinating. I mean, two of them are both from the 18th century and completely different. So one's Dr. Johnson, as he always calls him, Samuel Johnson, who wrote the first ever dictionary of the English language. He was very conservative and quite a kind of stickler, stick in the mud. The other is William Blake, the visionary, the poet, the radical. Blake, who said, energy is eternal delight. Blake, who said, without contraries is no progression. Blake is a huge influence on Bhante. Blake was absolutely true to his own inner vision, despite the fact that nobody at the time really, he had hardly any encouragement, hardly any support. He just carried on with this power of his own vision. And I think when we're understanding how important vision is to Bante, Blake's always very close by. And he's certainly very close by in Bante's imagination. And this, it's interesting, there's these pairs of opposites with Johnson and Blake. And Bante himself has talked about a great tension of opposites in himself. There's a lovely memoir of his times of wandering in India when he was in his 20s. He was a homeless wanderer in India. And he describes that there was this tension between two inner characters that he describes as Sangharakshita I, who's the poet, and Sangharakshita II, the ascetic monk. And he says, Sangharakshita I wanted to enjoy the beauty of nature, to read and write poetry, to listen to music, to look at paintings and sculpture, to experience emotion, to lie in bed and dream, to see places and meet people. Sangharakshita II wanted to realise the truth, to read and write philosophy, to observe the precepts, to get up early and meditate, to mortify the flesh, to fast and pray. Sometimes Sangharakshita I was victorious, sometimes Sangharakshita II, while occasionally there was an uneasy duumvirate. And he goes on to describe this violent clash where Sangharakshita II, the ascetic, burned the notebooks of Sangharakshita I, and they were both so shocked that they reached more of a chord between them. So he had these big energies, and they weren't always going in the same direction. And he says in a really interesting piece that Nagabodhi's written, we used to have a magazine called Dharma Life, which has got some fantastic stuff in it, and a lot of it's still available online. The magazine doesn't carry on. But what Nagabodhi says is that Bante said to him, he feels he would have gone mad with these great conflicting energies in him if he hadn't found some objective commitment as worthy or as all-consuming and noble as the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. So like what Bante needed in the middle of his mandala was something as massive as the three jewels to gather these big energies. Having said all that, he's got quite a... well, he says he doesn't have... There's certain illusions about himself that he doesn't have. And there's a fascinating little booklet, which is called My Relation to the Order, where he's talking about himself in relation to the movement, in relation to us, in relation to the order. And he says, one of the illusions about myself, which I do not cherish, is that I was the most suitable person to be the founder of a new Buddhist movement. And... he says, not only did the lotus, that is the movement, bloom from the mud, it had to bloom from the mud contained within a small and inadequate pot. And he describes how at times it was very, very difficult, this responsibility that he'd taken on. But at the same time, he says, far from feeling that it was I who took on the responsibility, I feel that it was the responsibility that took on me. So there's a sense of Bante of these, if you like, going back to the image of the kings and queens, these energies inside him that got woken up. It's like they're bigger than him, really. They're working through him, and he's kind of going, oh, there's something coming through, something going on here, that actually in a certain way he wasn't identifying with. He's a complex man with a lot of energy, and actually I've heard more than one of his most loyal senior disciples describe him with the same word, which is weird. But he's found a way to focus these vast and divergent energies behind this vision and inspiration, and he's created this worldwide movement. He's also acted in ways that some people have found very painful, and it's been on his mind. He's 91 now. Over Christmas, he was in hospital, he had pneumonia. And when he came back to Adhisthana from being in hospital when he was home, he posted a personal statement, which is on his website, where he'd obviously really been reflecting on this, really being aware that he's coming to the end of his life. And he reiterates what he said in that quote I read just now, which is, I have more than once said that I was not the best person to found a new Buddhist movement, but the only one that was available. And friends have sometimes assured themselves and others that my words were not to be taken literally, but were only a sign of my humility. But this is not the case. At the time, I meant them to be taken literally, and I still mean them to be taken literally. I, being its founder, Triratna, sometimes bears the mark not of the Dharma, but of my own particular personality. That personality is a complex one, and in certain respects I did not act in accord with what my position in the movement demanded, or even as a true Buddhist. I am thinking in particular of the times when I have hurt, harmed or upset fellow Buddhists, whether within Sri Ratna or out of it. He's not perfect. He never said he was perfect. Like the Buddha, Bhante has taught and encouraged us not to rely on him personally, but to rely on the Dharma that comes through him, the Dharma that he taught. He says, in that talk on Is a Guru Necessary, the Buddha never asked anyone to have faith in him, much less to have absolute faith. And it's very important to remember this. And again, there's this quote that he uses, that we should test the teachings in our experience as a goldsmith tests gold in the fire. We have to test them in our own experience and make them our own, see if they're actually helping, watering our own seeds and helping them to grow. The Buddha and Bhante both followed what sparked their own hearts, the seeds that were there. The Buddha followed the sparks, nurturing them till full, perfect awakening, enlightenment. And then he was able to elucidate the path for others to follow. Bhante first really heard the teachings of the Buddha when he heard the Diamond Sutra and Mahayana Sutra when he was in his teens. And he says, when I read the Diamond Sutra, I knew that I was a Buddhist. Though this book epitomizes a teaching of such rarefied sublimity that even arahants, saints who have attained individual nirvana, are said to become confused and afraid when they hear it for the first time, I at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known it and believed it and realized it ages before, and the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I had forgotten. So again, there's something else, that sense again of waking up something that was in him that he knew. So Bhante lived a long time in India, 20 years. He had many different teachers. He wasn't following their path of teaching. What he was doing was following their teachings to the extent that enabled him to unfold and grow those seeds within him, follow his own vision. He discovered the seeds of inspiration and vision. He nurtured them both with Dharma study and practice, but also with literature, with the arts. He's so much encouraged us. That's such a particular emphasis of our tradition, that beauty matters, that those things that nourish, water our seeds, open our hearts, are there to be cultivated for the benefit of our Dharma practice. And he came to recognise the difference of a Dharma life that's based around rules, rituals as ends in themselves, formulaic observances, and what is actually a real living practice that actually is that growing plant of inspiration that we can all have within all of us. And his life's work's been about trying to help other people to find that in themselves and unfold that. And that's how he's come to found the order. When he first came back to England in the 60s, he was planning to just carry on and work within the institutions that were already here. But after a couple of years, actually they'd had enough of his radical brand of Buddhism. He went back to India for a bit and they told him not to come back. And it's a lovely story about when he got this letter from the English Sangha Trust. And he said to his companion, you know what this means? It means a new Buddhist movement. So he came back, 1967, and that's when he started. He just started teaching, and we're going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary of when that started in April. It wasn't his plan. He didn't have a big master plan. I think so much has happened, it's easy to think Bhante had this great big master plan. He didn't. He's much more like a gardener than a strategic planner. He was much more like, oh, he could see what worked, and then he's encouraging that in others. And I'm going to have to speed up because of time. But that's how the order's grown. He came back, he met people like Ananda, who's here in Bristol, who's the only now remaining person from the first lot of ordinations that happened in 1968. He met people, he encouraged them to discover their own vision, their own inspiration. And the order and the movement unfolded from people following their own inspirations with his encouragement, with his teachings. And that's how we came to have centres, communities, right livelihood businesses, loads of different ways of practicing that have all unfolded from people's own individual inspirations. And he mentioned, there's a lovely image that he mentions in My Relation to the Order about this. He says, My limitation should not be the limitations of the order. The order should not be simply Sangharakshita writ large. Order members of particular temperaments have different talents, aptitudes and capacities. And in making their respective contributions to the life and work of the order, should use those capacities to full scope. The order should be a rich and many-splendored thing, with all kinds of facets. It doesn't have to just be a lotus lake, or even a series of lotus lakes. It can also be a rose garden or a cabbage patch, as you prefer. So it was a lovely tie-in with our talking about plants in the second week. So to conclude, I just want to say one more thing, which is there's a word that we chant in some Pali verses that we can't chant called the Tiratanavandana, which is homage to the three jewels. So it's a very early text that is woven into our way of practicing. And there's this lovely word in it, ahipasiko, and it means come and see, of the nature of a personal invitation. And I think this is how we can see what Bhante's offered us. In a way, he's there with his hand out. He's saying, come and see. And we could see that he's offering us gifts, and it's up to us whether we take them or not. And there's a poem of his that I really love, which is called The Four Gifts, which sums that up. So I'll conclude with that. I come to you with four gifts. 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 My first gift is a lotus flower. Do you understand? My second gift is a golden net. Do you recognize it? My third gift is a shepherd's round dance. Do your feet know how to dance? My fourth gift is a garden planted in a wilderness. Could you walk there? Do you understand? Do you recognize it? I come to you with four gifts. Dare you accept them?